This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about military service with Dr. Linnell Plummer. Guest we're so excited to talk to in such great depth on this topic. And we'll start off with some stats from the Mental Health Foundation via a recent study of theirs of 10,000 serving personnel, mostly regular service people, but also some reservists, and found that there were lower than expected levels of PTSD, but other common mental disorders and alcohol misuse specifically were the most frequently reported mental health problems among UK armed forces personnel. In particular, levels of alcohol misuse overall were substantially higher than the general population. So if we go more specifically into that, it was 13% reported alcohol misuse versus 4% reporting post-traumatic stress disorder.
You wouldn't necessarily assume, would you? Because PTSD seems like the buzzword or acronym that comes out of any conversations with regard to the military, the armed forces and mental health.
For sure.
It seems like you've got to really be in it to probably know a few the ins and outs of it, but people would always just go to PTSD as the thing.
Of course, it's definitely very much there. So, you know, one of the other things they did find highlighted was that regular personnel in combat roles were much more likely to report PTSD than those in support roles, office or other non-combat roles. So, you know, the link is 100% there and well understood. With something like this, maybe we have to take it with a pinch of salt because it was a survey. And so it may be that they were underreporting themselves, or the reporting of alcohol misuse could partly be a symptom for some people of undiagnosed PTSD.
Yeah.
So we have to take that into account, whereas when we talk about other types of prevalence stats, they often include underdiagnosis when making calculations. Because I had a quick look for the US, and the US Department of Veteran Affairs estimate that 4 out of 10 men and 10 out of 100 women in the general population experience PTSD at some point in their life.
The whole thing just goes to show that as soon as we look a little bit deeper and delve a little bit more, trauma have such a ripple effect on families and everybody concerned, whatever that trauma is, being in the military or not. But now we're really starting to see the impact on children and spouses left behind. And as you said, other things that occur, because, you know, the knock-on effect of one thing happening to something else happening, or abuse within the military, which we've spoken about before, alcoholism, racism, you know, discrimination, all of those kind of things that also have a massive impact on mental health. So when we're reporting or surveys that are being carried out, you know, really important now more than ever to start widening the things that we're looking for.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of progress being made on that in terms of what is considered to be trauma. You know, even we've noticed that in recent years, big changes mm-hmm. with what's considered trauma, like more consideration of emotional issues. You know, and that can very much extend to the way the military are having to, well, certainly I know for this country, are having to update their policies, because there was a point where it was very, were you in some kind of blast? Did you get shot? What is the physical thing that happened? And then the kind of what can be known as secondary trauma, although I don't really like that term, you know, if you lost somebody to one of those events, then the emotional trauma of that.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't like the term secondary, because often it's put as secondary of you're not the one that went through it, but we know that that can be something that triggers this kind of condition. In the same way, you're absolutely right, families can be so influenced by all kinds of trauma. I should mention, you know, with the difference between commonality in men and women, a lot of that is put down to the level of women that are victims to sexual assault. So that's something that's a big part of those stats in the military, but also in the rest of the world. But no, definitely we looked at stats for children that are growing up with a parent who's serving. And a study published in BMC Medical, which found that the largest effect for these children was internalizing symptoms of anxiety and depression, which arise from the existence of fears for the deployed parent's safety.
We can imagine, actually, because what sits in between that as well is the parent then that is at home and the impact that their deployed spouse has on their mental health. You could see how the child instinctively would become quite aware. We know that at home domestically, whether or not you're in the military or not, of your parents' mental health. And then if you've got a mum or a dad at home that you know is struggling with fear and gripped with fear of what might happen to the spouse, you're then the kid at home picking up on all those vibes. And the last thing you're probably going to do is say, I'm really struggling, mum or dad. So the internalised point in that statistic is probably quite key. I reckon that happens a lot in that sense, in every sense, domestic, you know.
Of course, like I said, and a big part of that will be that they don't yet have the ability to distinguish for themselves the level of risk, you know, because you might ask that parent and they may say, oh, no, you know, this should be a relatively safe deployment. They can act with the logic to kind of manage their fear. The child can pick up on that fear, but they don't have the logic to back it up and help them cope. And I don't remember if we spoke about that specifically, but we talked about this in some depth with our guest who came from a military family and then went on to serve herself. So it's been both sides of that. And another thing we talked about in some depth was the don't ask, don't tell policy in the US, which was in place while she was serving and a big part of shaping some really significant experiences for her. So if you'll indulge me, I have a little history lesson about that.
Do it. I can't believe I didn't know about it until like I was researching and it's blown my mind. It's just made me wanting to look into it more. I can't actually believe it. So do it. Indulge us.
Yeah. And luckily, you know, we haven't had a policy like that in this country, but a lot of elements of it, there's crossover definitely. So I've typed something up. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the official United States policy on military service by gay men, bisexuals and lesbians instituted by the Clinton administration. This policy began back in February the 28th, 1994. And prior to that, individuals who didn't identify as heterosexual were not allowed to serve in the United States military. That context is quite important because whilst this has been a very controversial bill, which in essence meant that those serving who were of one of these sexuality identities were not allowed to disclose that. And so it came in at the time, it was seen by many as actually quite progressive because it was progress in terms of people who were not heterosexual being allowed to serve at all. But it meant that you were allowed to serve as long as you were secretive about your identity. You couldn't talk about partners, you couldn't talk about anything that might give it away. And it created a lot of problems if that was an issue for you. You know, if you're having trouble at home, you can't go to get support that your straight colleagues would be able to. And so at the time, it was a very controversial policy because the majority of military officers were against the presence of homosexuals in particular in the armed forces. And so that's the context under why it seemed progressive to some, because most of the military were against it. And prior to this, there was no presence at all. And so this changed that. However, these cracks were there from the beginning. And then if we fast forward to the Iraq War, the policy came under further scrutiny as many Arab translators who were gay were discharged by the military. Then in 2010, the Pentagon released a report into its study on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which found that repealing the policy would pose little risk to military effectiveness. Plus, by this point, 70% of service members surveyed believed that ending the policy would not have a negative impact. So massive change from the majority being opposed to anyone but straight identifying people serving at all to then about 15 years later, the majority of people wanting this oppressive bill to be repealed. So these service members could not only remain, but could serve openly and honestly and get all the support they might need. The following year, the policy was repealed under Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. Obama said of this progress, "It is time to recognize that sacrifice, valor, and integrity are no more defined by sexual orientation than they are by race, gender, religion, or creed." Today, 70,000 LGB people are now members of the American Armed Forces and able to serve openly. In July 2017, the fight is not over, Trump stated via Twitter that transgender individuals will no longer be allowed to serve. Joe Biden has pledged that one of his first acts in office will be to overturn this decision by executive order. So our message to Joe, we'll be watching, as will about 10,000 individuals who are keen to serve once more.
It shocks me, the recency of it. Sometimes I think, is that because I show my age? You know, when like, as you get older, 20 years doesn't seem a long time. Mm. When you're 15, you don't talk about 20 years ago. Or even when you're 25, you don't talk about 20 years ago. You were five. To me, I can't believe that even in Britain, you were only allowed to serve openly as a gay person from 2000. 2000 seems like the other day to me. Like, it's not that long ago, but my goodness, like you've said, look what you just read out about America. You know, there's still something in place that somebody's identity means that they cannot serve.
Right. And that's the thing. You're absolutely right. Whether it's here or in the States, if it's within living memory, it can, of course, be still influencing people.
Yeah. Wow.
And I'm glad to get to talk about it. Obviously, we know the context of the people mentioned, and Joe Biden has more influence than ever before, whilst another person will not be able to tweet any longer about policies or indeed anything. So it's nice that even since there's some progress.
I know we've always tried to not be political or on this show, and I think it's hilarious because since I've been working with you, you were really like neutral, not in your own views, but in terms of like on the show, you want to remain neutral because we do want to be inclusive. But this last year, like this last couple of years, with this guy being just so on top and just a different, I'm talking about Donald Trump, it's just been very difficult to be like, no, we remain neutral. But
definitely.
You know what I mean?
No, I do know what you mean, definitely. And I think the nice thing is, on certain things, I think we sort of have to be political. And so when it comes into mental health, then it's sort of free rein for us to criticise. So a bit of additional context on kicking out any service personnel that are transgender from the US military under Trump, that decision was very much a financial one. So Trump didn't like the idea that the US military was paying for people's, let's say, testosterone. You know, something that if you're a trans man, you regularly have testosterone to level out your hormones and keep your transition stable, essentially. This is what it came down to. He didn't want to pay for that, even though, you know, healthcare is covered as part of being service personnel. He just didn't want to pay for that part of the healthcare.
Yeah.
So when you're making those kind of decisions, I think it's free rein for us to say things.
Just slag him off, basically. Yeah. I do think that our show represents us, hopefully, and that represents, we hope, exclusivity, doesn't it? That's the wrong word. It's complete opposite word.
Inclusivity, you mean?
Inclusivity. Let's just see what happens. But yeah, I just find it an interesting thing around having the guests come on. And
Pete, you should leave in the bit about Danielle's words. But that was funny. Exclusivity.
Asking our producer to leave in my mess up, basically. That's what Bobby's doing right now.
Yep, your true colours are going to shine through. You're all about exclusivity. And one thing, this isn't as fun, unfortunately, to talk about, but one thing I do want to kind of lastly finish up on, because I'm aware, you know, so we're recording this on the 11th of January. This will go out in 2 Thursdays time. And watching the news very closely as I do, I would expect we will be in or near the peak of the third wave of the pandemic when you're hearing this. And so I just kind of wanted to finish up acknowledging that, because it's been such a difficult time. It's felt, I almost said up and down, but honestly, a lot of the pandemic has felt quite consistently different levels of down. In many ways, this feels like the darkest point. I think Danielle and I have had a lot of time, and luckily things like the show and the wonderful guests we have on, we're very surrounded by positive people that have great tips for us about our mental health. But it's still very difficult, and there's still really difficult days. And so we're just kind of thinking of all of you out there. We know it's a tough time. We'd encourage you to listen back to episodes. Remember, they don't have to be listened to in sequence. So you can go listen to any that seem particularly relevant for how you're feeling, like we did the one on loneliness, we did the one on grief, because yeah, we just want to make sure you guys are looking after yourself. And if that's listening to more of this podcast, to distract or empower, either way, by all means. And look at me offering the podcast like it's not already free. you may have it. It's already accessible, but you may have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately we'll see what happens. Obviously, my hope is that this will be managed very well. I am concerned, this isn't a political point, this is a healthcare point, that we are dealing with a more contagious strain of the virus, potentially 50 to 70% is the latest estimates of how much more contagious it is. And yet we've gone into a lockdown which is less strict than the original lockdown with the original variant. So I fully hope that by the time you're hearing this, more measures have come in so that we can all be safe. I am concerned by a lot of the press at the moment, a lot of the encouragement for people to follow the rules. That's absolutely necessary. We here at Mental agree, follow the rules. I do worry slightly that the issue is less about if some people aren't following the rules and more about the rules being stricter. So I guess that's my message. You know, we're thinking of you, you know, we're all trying to get through it and we hope that you are taking it seriously. And maybe the tip is, like we're doing, take it a little bit more seriously than we have to.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. We are absolute advocates of following the rules and have been since day one. And my message is to all parents out there, listen to us if you need to keep your head together. This pandemic, this lockdown is just so much worse for me and for a lot of the parents that I speak to than last time. We've got shorter days, which means for one, it feels like the tomorrow's come already. And, you know, in the summer, we were those with gardens or not, just fortunate enough to be outside so much more. And then there's this homeschooling, which is great if your kid's like 10 or over and can manage a laptop. But if you've got a six-year-old on Zoom, every 20 minutes there's someone's pressed the wrong button, or we now lost the thing, or I'm on pause, I can't speak, or we've completely cut off, or teachers have had, like, I'm monitoring her on Zoom, which I'm actually finding tricky. And I think the teachers have been amazing, and thank you so much for the teachers and the office and support staff who have just turned this around so quickly. You know, we went to bed at 8 o'clock on last Monday night, my children, thinking they were going to school on Tuesday. By 10 o'clock, there's an announcement to say they're not going. And then by Tuesday afternoon, we've got links for online classes. The teachers are running around. The office staff are working 8, 9 o'clock at night to try and get us going. So big respect to all of those people and all of those educators. But yeah, my message is, parents, I feel your pain. Let's just stay strong and get through it and try and find some gratitude in the day-to-day stuff.
Love it. Very good. And so we'll wrap up this slightly longer intro by talking about our guest, who is a counsellor who founded Onyx Therapy Group. Dr. Plummer was such a delight to talk to. As I said, we went into such depth with loads of different areas of what it is to have your mental health affected by military service, your own or somebody else's. But also, you know, she talks about the positive. So yeah, fascinating interview. So please enjoy this interview with Dr. Plummer in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at traceminerals.com.
My name is Dr. Linnell Plummer, and my first experience of recognizing mental health was when I was a young child. I was probably about 6 or 7, and I realized that so many people in my neighborhood were addicted to drugs. Back in the 80s, and we didn't associate drugs with it at the time, but I knew that something had to be wrong for people to choose drugs over other things, right? Like, my mom was addicted to drugs, and I would often wonder, why are you choosing the drugs over me, right? Like, why are you choosing to be out making those decisions and compromising what felt safe and healthy for me for the drugs? That's when I realized that something was wrong to some degree. Not that we can judge mental health on right or wrong, but that's when I knew that this wasn't what all the other kids were experiencing. It did have a sense of normalization in my community, but as I continued, I was always a nerd and I would read books. And as I continued to grow older, that's when I realized that at the time it was more called like a psychological issues. And I was like, oh, one must have psychological issues to be dependent on these drugs. Later in life is when I really started delving deeper into what my mother's mental health issues would have been or could have been that turned her to drugs. And I realized later it was trauma, but sometimes it's still hard to kind of bounce back when you've been the recipient of a person that has untreated mental health issues. Sometimes it's hard to move past the behaviors that they did or the behaviors that they inflicted on you because of their mental health issues.
Of course. And it's clear even in the way you describe it, the compassion you had from that young age, that you saw there was something more going on. So you saw that link of this behavior, how it was affecting the parenting you received. Do you mind sharing a little bit more about that?
I think in my mom's heart, I know that my mom wanted me, right? And I think that many of my friends at the time, I think their parents wanted them, right? There were options and our parents in those moments chose to have us, right? And chose to keep us with them. And so because of that, she did make sure that there was a period of homelessness. But for the most part, she kept me in an apartment. Like I had physical safety in terms of shelter. And I would get the food assistance that the government provided at the time. But the love and the nurturing, the attention, the presence were all compromised because of her drug addiction. So the money that probably could have been spent on helping me or developing me or taking care of me was spent on drugs. So to some degree, as I got older and processed it, it felt like I was in competition with the drugs, right? Like, is it me or is it the drugs? Which one is it going to be? And really what it was is her mental health. It wasn't the compromise of the drugs per se. It was that she didn't know how to take care of herself. And this was her coping mechanism. And as I grew, then that's really what brought me into being more curious about mental health and psychological services and experiences and things like that, because I wanted my mom to get treatment, but I wanted her to be better. But that's not anything that was really offered in our communities, in our neighborhoods. And there's lots of reasons why. And there's lots of kids who suffered because their parents chose drugs because that was their way of coping with their mental health. And then later in life, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, suicide. So that's when I started paying closer attention to mental health from a genetic and generational environmental standpoint. It was like all around me because I choose it, but also my life because I didn't choose it, right? Like I was born into this situation where untreated could really have negative and lifelong implications on one's life and for generations to come.
For sure. And it's clear that you really saw that through the different generations of your family. And during this time, was your dad away serving?
He was, yeah. My parents have what I consider like a beautiful little love story that had bumps and bruises in it. But when my mom found out that she was pregnant, my dad wanted to create a new life for me and wanted me to kind of be able to get out of certain situations. And he made the choice to go into the military. But there was a gap where he wasn't present at all. And that's when I really saw the negative implications. And then later he kind of came back into the picture in a different kind of way. But yeah, my dad was away in the military, so he joined the military when my mom was 4 months pregnant. Yeah, and he got out when I was 25 years old.
Wow. So really spanning that whole pivotal time of your development then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had wonderful opportunities to live with him too. So when I was about to enter high school, I went to go live with him in Seoul, Korea. He was stationed there. Then I graduated high school in Mililani, Hawaii. He was stationed in Hawaii as well. And then I came over to DC and then I ended up joining the military after I finished my undergraduate degree. And then I got a chance to do 8 years in the military too. And so my kids have I guess technically they can consider themselves military brats too. So it's been generations. My son talks about joining the military, so we'll see.
Did you just say military brats?
Yeah.
Is that the phrase you used? Yeah, because that's one that I think if people are outside of that world, they won't even be familiar with that term of offspring of military personnel.
Yeah, those of us who are the children of the military service person, we're called military brats. I even, somewhere in my house, maybe upstairs, I even have a little plaque that says military brats. And I think my dad is actually the one that bought it for me. And the brat is a, what is the word? It like means something. I can't think of the term right now. Yeah, it's like an acronym. But yeah, they call us military brats because we have a whole different experience than other people whose parents are not in the military, especially when we're moving around every couple years and we have stability within the family, but we don't have stability in location. And it means something different when you know that your parents can be deployed and they can die, right? Like, I don't think kids outside of military families actively think about their parents dying, but it's a reality for us. Like, we have paperwork that's involved and, you know, we have training experiences of what we're going to do when we have to evacuate a base or things like that. So we're actively aware that our parents could die at any point. And so it's a different kind of mentality. And it falls definitely into mental health because, you know, many kids can live a more carefree kind of experience. But when you are aware that your parents are sacrificing so much, then it's scary. And going back and doing a comparison, at one point, it did feel like my dad was choosing the military over me too, because he could have died and left me without him. Luckily, that's not what happened for me, but it is what happened to different military brats that I know and many that I don't know as well. We never guilt them about that though. You know, that's the choice that they made. And we appreciate that because their military service keeps us safe. But it's a reality for us as military brats too. So saying all of that to say that we do have a special name that we're referred to, and it's primarily because we have a different cultural perspective within our families and communities.
Right. And I think that's so important because it is beyond even just a distinct outlook. It's a whole lifestyle. It's a different way of growing up. And from other people I've known in that situation, they also talk about so many of the benefits of that. That, you know, yes, there is that present danger, you know, that there is that risk, that instability, that moving around, but also, you know, you got to live in countries you otherwise would have never found yourself in. And you appreciate your dad when he is around because he's not always. Yeah. And even from a mental health perspective, I think there can be something to knowing the most likely threat that you are perhaps in some ways less likely to worry about everything because you know the biggest danger to your family. You're familiar with it. You understand from a young age what the reasons behind that is.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's something I can kind of parallel with my own mental health in a way that with some of the things I've been through, as difficult as they've been, one benefit I do see is that I'm now familiar with what certainly feels like the biggest threat to my life.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. With the statistics around male suicide, eating disorders having really high death rates as well, you know, I've kind of got familiar with what is the most likely threat to my life. And in learning to manage that, I somehow feel safer.
Yes.
Even though to the outside, people might think, oh, but you're at more risk. Your health is more turbulent.
Yeah. And I think that's the cool thing about mental health, right? Because the more that you do know and the more that you are able to process, you can develop some coping skills and coping mechanisms around that. You can prepare and plan because you have the information and the knowledge. It's when you don't know, when something isn't labeled, when something isn't clear, that the ambiguity of it, the uncertainty of it tends to take over. And that's where we see a lot of anxiety showing up in situations and places as well, because one doesn't have the information, which is why I love podcasts like yours and others that are focusing on mental health, because it increases people's knowledge and their awareness. And then they hear something like, yes, that resonates with me. That makes sense with me. Now let me go ahead and explore a little bit more. And for folks that have military service experience or they are part of military families, you know, mental health wasn't something that we talked about often because the perception of unstable mental health meant that one may not be able to serve and do their job, right? So if anybody suspects that you have mental health issues or that you're receiving some sort of counseling or anything like that, then there was negative consequences to it. And for some people, that negative consequence was as severe as having to be released from the military. And that means a lot when you have a family that you're trying to support or goals that you have for yourself or dreams for yourself. And so oftentimes those mental health experiences were hidden. They were suppressed. They were unaddressed because the consequences felt far greater. I think after some of the wars that the United States have participated in, they've made it a bit more accessible, but it's still not 100% available or where it is. And so the cool overlap is that being a military brat and serving in the military myself and knowing mental health very intimately, there were elements of intersection that I was able to help people with because I knew it very well, but also help myself with because I knew it very well too. So I think the military is trying to do better and will continue to do better. But the mental health issues in the military are very present, and not just the service person, but their families as well.
Absolutely. And I really can see that in terms of how it's such a big part of your identity, that even though things are getting better, that fear is still so prevalent that you could be kicked out of service. And then who are you when you're so used to, right down to being referred to according to your rank?
Yes.
And out in the rest of the world, what's left of your identity?
It's so interesting that you mentioned that. When my daddy got out of the military, I was practicing therapy at the time. So I was able to pay attention to what was happening to him while he was transitioning, because the military gives you a transition period, right? If you're getting an honorable discharge, you get a transition period, and he wasn't doing well. And I remember having a conversation with him similar to the one that you just mentioned, because when he's on base, he's in his uniform. And so people know his rank. And even if he's not in uniform, he has been in uniform so much that people still know who he is, right? So they will call him by his rank, just like you mentioned. But when he got out the military, he was a regular civilian. And that did cause some issues for him. What ended up happening shortly after that is that he chose as a civilian to get a government contract job and went overseas because he needed more time to transition into a civilian role while having some overlap, because in the job right after he left the military, they were still referring to him by his rank, even though he was a civilian. So it took a lot of transition time. And for some people, they get to acknowledge that. And for some people, they don't. I do believe that if it had continued without us intervening in the way that we did, that he would have developed a sense of depression because he would not have known himself outside of his job in the military. Even if he had moments of like insecurity, it was protected by the fact that he was high ranking in the military. And without the uniform, without the acknowledgement, he had to face what some of those things were. And luckily, again, we have a history of mental health awareness in our family, but there's so many military personnel who don't. And so they don't know what's happening to them when they get out, and they're not getting what they need, and they're lost and they're confused because, like we mentioned a few minutes ago, they don't have the information and the knowledge. They've been conditioned to be ashamed of mental health issues. And so that's when we see some of the trauma that happens post-service because they don't know what to do.
And so what was your experience like when you were serving?
Oh, man. I'm proud to say that I'm a veteran, but my military experience was pretty tough. I think because of my intersections, right? I'm, you know, serving in the United States Army as a Black woman, and I was fiery. You wouldn't believe how fiery I was. I thought I knew everything, right? Because most people in their early 20s do, right? They think they know everything.
So I'd imagine with your relatives serving as well, you probably thought you already knew how to be a soldier.
I just knew I was a general already. I was a general. You didn't even have to say anything to me, you know?
Yeah, from what I know, they don't like that.
They wanted to put me in my place so often, and I was young, and so I did not want to be put in any sort of place. But there were so many intersections, like we talked about a few minutes ago with growing up and seeing mental health around me. There's so many intersections. So it's not just one thing that creates an experience, right? So for me, my experience was pretty tough because I'm not one that does really well with institutions and systems when I see a flaw. And I believe that there were flaws in the military and I wanted to address those. And they did not want me to address those because it's an institution, right? So they want to keep the institution in place.
And also you were probably not perceived as being a high enough rank to have an opinion on certain things.
Right. So although I was an officer and had more rank than maybe some enlisted folks, I was still young. And I looked young. And when I reflect back on it, sometimes some of my behaviors were pretty young. So although I was mature, I was still young acting in some ways. the military is good for helping to get that out of one person, because you can't be too immature when you're willing to fight and die for a country, right? Like, there has to be some maturity in your decisions and your actions. So I was still rather mature, but still very immature in some ways. If I had to do it again, I would do it again. Even though the experience wasn't pleasant for me, the positives outweighed. So if somebody told me, hey, we need you to go back into the military, I would find a way to make it work, even though I might be a little upset at times. But the benefits were beautiful. One of my best friends is one of my former soldiers, so we developed a really great relationship. Many of the skills that I have towards success I developed while I was in the military or training to get ready for the military. Being a leader right now, a lot of those things, my discipline, the character development, the relationships I built outweighed some of the negative experiences that I had. But I would be remiss not to acknowledge that I believe some of the negative experiences I had was because of my race, my gender, my age. And if we want to be even more transparent, probably even my sexuality, because the military that I was a member of was still very much on the secrecy of sexuality. I identify as a bisexual woman, but there were elements of that that I could not talk about and could not disclose. And even in the secrecy of some of my professional relationships with some of my soldiers, they shared with me their sexuality, like by talking and talking to me about it. And still, I saw the pain and the struggle that they had in not being able to live very openly. So when we have like family days and all the heterosexual couples are able to bring their spouses or their girlfriends and their boyfriends and things like that, the ones who were in the community would end up saying, like, you know, I'm single. Meanwhile, they've been in a relationship for 5 years, right? They just can't tell anybody, which was a form of evolution, because prior to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, people were able to ask. And if you answered honestly, the consequences could be that you were removed from the military. The consequences could be that your rank was reduced. The consequences were that your pay was reduced. The consequences were career impacting, family impacting, community impacting. So the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, although it was a Band-Aid, it was the president's way at the time to protect people in the LGBT community. The command was to those who ask, do not ask, because they were asking and people were telling the truth and getting kicked out, or people were lying and then getting kicked out. Because when you lie in the military, it's an offense and you could get kicked out for that, because one of our values is integrity. Eventually, it evolved and now you can live how you want to live. Still not 100% supported, but there's no professional consequences. There's now social consequences. And part of that is related to the bravado of gender, right? Like, because historically the military was made of men and being a homosexual was considered to be less. Part of it was also because of the access, right? Some homophobic people tend to think that every gay or bisexual or queer person is attracted to them. So they're, you know, they're like, I don't want you looking at me. Well, nobody was looking at you in the first place. So
it's a bit of an arrogant way of looking at it.
Like,
not every person of the opposite gender is attracted to you, as you well know.
Exactly. And I struggle with that too as a bisexual woman.
And do you mind sharing a bit of that? Because I can see, like you say, that it was an improvement on what had come prior. Because, of course, by today's standards, we can see the complete illogical nature of something like reducing pay. I didn't even know that was one of them. Like, I don't even know at the time how you justify it. It's madness. So how were things for you?
Because I'm a bisexual woman, and at the time that I was in the military, I was also having children with my boyfriend at the time, my fiance at the time, which was a guy. So people didn't look at me, interestingly, or differently. However, I was always the type of officer that was present and available with my soldiers. So I knew which of my soldiers were queer, and I felt so much pain and compassion, because had I not been in a relationship with that guy who I had children with, I could have been in a relationship with a woman and experiencing the same things that they felt. So it felt very conflicting at times, where I'm able to bring my boyfriend to the family day, but they're not able to bring theirs. So it would be lots of long conversations with my soldiers, because they test a little bit. They use a keyword here or there to see if you pick up on it. Are you safe for me to talk to you about my sexuality in the military? They would choose those keywords with me and I would catch on. And tell them, you know, let's go and have a moment, because I was an officer. I was able to have soldiers in my office and let them know, like, it's safe. Tell me, like, what's going on? Kind of release it.
Somebody was going to take the risk first, and usually it was my soldier, because they would use a key word, or they would call their partners by very gender neutral names, like Sam, right? When Sam could mean Samuel, but Sam could also mean Samantha. I would pick up on things like that. And I'd be like, what's Sam's real name? You know, Sam is a nickname. What's Sam's real name? And they'd be like, oh, ma'am, I'm not going to tell you. And in that moment, I knew that they were lesbian, because if they were not, they would just say Samuel. And so then we would kind of go from there. In those situations, I would tell them too, like, you know, I identify as bisexual. Bisexual folks don't always get a good rap in the LGBTQ community, right? Like, people consider us one step in and one step out. So some soldiers were receptive to the reality that I was bisexual, and some of them weren't. But I never said anything to my commanders, because it just wasn't safe for my career. And
with that fear that many of your soldiers felt about opening up and needing maybe specific support, did you find yourself having that same fear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had that fear. And in the U.S., years ago, there would be clubs that were specific for people in the LGBTQ community, right? Like little secret clubs. Like, you have the speakeasies that happened during Prohibition, the Prohibition period in the U.S., which was around alcohol, because it wasn't legal. But then we would also have these private clubs where we would go and we could finally be free. And I say we, although I wasn't born at that time, I'm connected to that community, right? That is my community as well. And so we have gotten comfortable with getting little bits here and there, little bits of freedom here and there. So we in the military, if you were a part of the LGBTQ community, you often knew who else was, because you saw them at an event, you saw them at somebody's house, and it happened to be a lot of gay people at that house. You saw something. So there was a small sense of community that was there, but it's still not anything that we shared with anybody outside of.
It's so fascinating, because it sort of harks back to an earlier time in the US more broadly, where there was that secrecy, that you would know who each other were, but you could never openly acknowledge it. And so whilst the rest of the world was moving on more so, these rules that were brought in to help protect you were also oppressive.
They were absolutely oppressive, yeah. And there were certain benefits of knowing who was in the community and knowing that they couldn't say, hey, I saw Captain Plummer over at this party, because to say that you saw me at that party meant that you too were at that party. And so you were outing yourself if you outed me. So there were some protections around that way, in case people got upset or vengeful later on and they wanted to get you in trouble. Because again, you could get in trouble. There were consequences related to it. It was a tough period. And I actually didn't come out to the rest of the world until 2014. And I had been out of the military for 4 years at that point, almost 4 years. And there were many of my military friends like, what? So this whole time you was bisexual and you didn't say anything? And I was like, how could I? How could I say anything and not experience consequences? How could I? And it's even worse for soldiers who live on base, because there's not that much escape. I didn't live on military base. So I was able to have time away from the military to live a more free or liberated life, even though I was still hiding elements of it.
Feel like for those 4 years then you had a kind of shame that was a hangover from these restrictions?
Yeah. Yeah. And not just from the military, but from society as a whole, because again, my context is a Black woman in the U.S. And then I had to be ready to be marginalized and oppressed because of my sexuality, too. It was just a matter of, do I really want to introduce this to the whole world and give people another reason to treat me differently? And eventually I made the decision to do it, because as a therapist, I was telling my clients to live a true and authentic life, and I was still hiding part of mine. And sure, we could have privacy in our lives, right? But there's a difference between privacy because you want privacy and privacy because you're ashamed, or privacy because you don't want to be authentic. So it was actually the work that I was doing in the mental health field that kind of forced me or propelled me. It wasn't force, it wasn't coercion, but that kind of propelled me to tell the truth about my sexuality. And I've loved it ever since. I have felt a sense of liberation. I feel emotional right now, and so forgive me. I'm like, ooh, but I feel a sense of liberation since coming out. And so I get to be in a cool position, because I will always be a veteran that can never be taken away from me. So I will always be a veteran, but I get to also talk about the intersection of being in the military, being bisexual, and understanding the mental health behind it. You know, many of our folks are still dealing with agony and pain because even though they can say something, there's still, like I said, social consequences. There's not career consequences anymore. But, you know, people are subjective, right? So even when you go in front of promotion boards, if you have somebody who doesn't really like you, you know, and they're homophobic, it could still be used against you. It can't technically, where in the past it technically could be used against you. Now it's more subjectively. So people still have some risk. There's still some growing that the institution of the military has to make adjustments on. So, and people who are major defenders of the military will say, no, we have gay and lesbian soldiers. But in the U.S., we recently had, you know, a president, you know, well, we don't have to go into the politics behind it, but that still tried to take away certain rights from transgender folks in the military. Yeah. So when your rights are still debatable in politics, it doesn't feel secure.
Right. And I think this is something that people can not think about at times is it's not just the rights. At times, it's your very existence. Because if hypothetically a rule came in where, you know, like what happened with the transgender community, if people from sexualities outside of being heterosexual were no longer allowed to serve, that's not the same as none of them would serve. It would go back to the secrecy again. And so it's not just the idea of whether or not you have those rights, it's whether or not you're allowed to exist in certain spaces. And that's massive. And so it's really powerful to hear how you're kind of reclaiming that in hindsight, that you're speaking up now for all the years that you couldn't.
Yes, and all the people that couldn't. I mean, there were people who died in military service because of their sexuality. Who's speaking for them? I have to speak for them. You know what I mean? There were people whose lives were completely flipped upside down, and now they're living in homelessness and they're living in extreme consequences and poverty because of their sexuality. Who's speaking for them? I've been given an opportunity to speak to you and speak to others, and I have a platform to talk. And so I have to talk for people who couldn't or who can't or who didn't or who's gone. Yeah. And I get to talk from a very intimate position. It's not just advocacy. It's my life, too. Yeah, I do speak for them.
Of course. I love that. And so to bring in a parallel then with mental health, there was this stigma around sexuality. But were you even, you know, before your training in counseling, seeing the mental health impact of those serving? And were there particular conditions you were seeing prevalence of?
Yeah. So one of the positions that I served in the military was the security officer. So I did the background checks for all of my folks. One of the questions on the old security forms was around if you've ever experienced any psychological or mental health issues. And people would lie, because if you had mental health issues, like I mentioned before, the consequences were, of course, you couldn't deploy, but that meant you couldn't serve. And for some people, that meant that you also were going to have a consequence related to your career, your rank, and your pay. But because I had training in mental health and I was asking these questions, I could read body language. So when people were getting to that question and they were starting to shift a little bit, or their eye contact changed or their body language changed, I knew something. And again, I couldn't ask other than the way that the question was asked. I couldn't ask outside of how the question was formed for the security clearance, but I knew, and they eventually realized that I knew. One of the cool things that happened while some of my soldiers were deployed, I was the rear detachment commander because I was pregnant with my son. And so I stayed behind. Of course, they're not deploying anybody that's pregnant. And one of the things that I asked and advocated for was to provide family counseling while soldiers were deployed. And the military gave me that option. They said, yes, that I could do that. And I was able to support those soldiers who were deployed and they were experiencing mental health issues. And I was able to do it within the context of the family. So the other soldiers didn't know that it was happening because we just called it like a check-in with Captain Plummer. And so it didn't seem like there was anything wrong or off. But yes, people often came to me, or I would pick up on things and I would find a way to ask them, because again, I was an officer. I was able to use that platform, that access, and the privacy of my office to have conversations that could not otherwise be had. I guess to some degree, I was like an undercover counselor in that I could see that something was going on and I would find a way to bring it up. That's one of the counseling skills that we get to have, though, you know, exploring conversations and context without always having to be super direct, which gives people the opportunity to kind of open up if they're wanting or willing to.
Yeah.
In a funny way, it makes me think of that being quite military in itself, that you were finding covert ways to go about it.
I was.
And then once I started building up the therapy practice, I was thinking about other ways to support folks that are in the military so that they don't have to report back that they've been working with me. Because if they report back that they've been working with me again, there's consequences related to that. So I'm talking about in my professional world as a counselor, me being outside of the military now, and how, you know, we would have to take cash payments instead of using their insurance. Because if we use their insurance, then the military could go back and see where their insurance was being used. And that way they knew that they were getting counseling services. So we'd have to do cash payments, or we'd have to reduce the session so that they could pay for it, and things like that. Some of my friends have been really good in supporting the military psychological support services, especially at some of our big military bases here. But there's still stigma related to it, and there was definitely stigma related to it. I joined the military in 2002, so almost 20 years ago. There's been some advances since then, but it's not perfect, and it's far from perfect.
Fair play to you for creating a counseling service in such a stigmatized environment.
Thank you. But like this to the question you said a second ago, I got to speak, I got to do it, right? Like I have access and people trailblaze for me, and now I get to just widen the path for those coming behind me so that they could walk with me and they could get the support that they need. Because the military is a tough job, and being a military spouse or a military child, it's tough too. And people should be able to talk about that. Of course, we know very commonly around PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, we've historically used that for people in the military. So we know that that's there, but there's also depression, there's also anxiety, there's substance use disorder, and you could get kicked out of the military for substance use, not realizing that many people are using substances to cope with other mental health issues that they can't talk about, right? So we drink quite socially, but if you overdrink, it's a bad thing. But sometimes you're overdrinking because you don't want to deal with the depression, or you're overdrinking because you're trying to relax your mind from anxiety, right?
Right. Or the trauma. And of course, that's the case because people do that in the civilian world. People exactly. Overdrink to forget a difficult week of work.
Yeah.
And are their friends aren't dying? You know what I mean? Like you're surrounded by death. And yes, there's many benefits to being in the military. The military will take care of you while you're in, and even when you get out, if you have an honorable discharge. But there should not be consequences related to anything related to mental health. You know, are we given consequences when a person has diabetes? No. So why are we given consequences when a person has depression?
Right. And that's massive, because particularly the way you've talked about how things used to be, if you were then dishonorably discharged due to sexuality or mental health issues, you're not just losing your role, you're losing your identity, as we've mentioned, and your support system.
Yes, because you are with these soldiers quite frequently. So even though we're on rotation to military bases and things like that, that's still your support system, and you're around people who know, and you don't have to explain. You don't have to explain what it means to be thinking about the fact that you are away from your family because you're with other soldiers who are away from their family, right? And you don't have to think about, you know, how you have fallen in love with this person over there, but the military has now deployed you. And so you can't continue the relationship in the way that you once had. So your dating life is different and things like that. And so you don't have to explain those things when you're talking to other military people because they know it. They've lived it as well. But when that is taken away from you, then you're left like kind of alone. Which is why they're doing more supportive services for veterans now, too. And now for clarification, if you are released because you have mental health issues, it's not a dishonorable discharge. It's a general discharge, which means that you could get some services, but you can't get all of your services. So the military, the Army at least has three different types of discharges. So there's the dishonorable, the general, and the honorable. Mm-hmm. And the general is kind of the catch-all for folks. I had a cousin, and he was young when he got in. He was 18, trying to escape poverty and things like that. And he was great. He was a great young soldier. But one of the things that people don't often talk about is that in the middle of war, the military has a way of rewarding soldiers who kill because we're at war, right? So the psychological implications of that is that whatever you get positively reinforced for, so whatever you get an award for, you will continue to do because your mind is telling you and your environment is telling you that that's the right decision. There's an assumption that you should know but the enemy is not clearly defined when you're at home. So when you're overseas, you know who your enemy is. They tell you who the enemy is. They show you who the enemy is. They show you pictures of the enemy, what the enemy might be wearing, what the enemy might do, where they are. When you're at home, if you feel triggered by something, that person becomes your enemy. If your spouse does something to just disrespect you or upset you, your mind will tell you that's the enemy. So the military has to do a little bit better job of post-deployment training. I think they are now. But the consequence for that is that my cousin came home and found himself in a tough position with his wife at the time. And he did something that was extremely inappropriate. He did not kill her, but it was completely inappropriate. And he was released from the military. At the time of his release, he was 20 and he got a dishonorable discharge because the military is clear about how they expect you to treat your family. But I partially blame the military for that because he was 18 and he was being reinforced for harming others. And there was no good training around what to do when you get back home. So he took some of those same behaviors and he extended it to his wife, and then the military let him go. And I felt that that was irresponsible of the military because they trained him and then they got mad at him when he used it in the wrong environment.
Because of course we have to have those boundaries, but you're right, we have to be so careful how this kind of training can contribute to horrible choices, you know, both within the service and outside. And so I know one thing that's a big focus with military in the UK is not to do that rewarding. So instead, even if there probably are situations where people get rewarded for that, but the way that it's presented is always you in this role or this particular day or operation, you protected life.
Yes.
So maybe you blew up an enemy base, but in doing so, you protected this many lives of your soldiers. And yes. It's always phrased in that way.
Yes.
You know, so it sometimes can be as simple as the phrasing of it can mm-hmm. make such a difference.
It, absolutely.
Now he's, let me see. I'm trying to calculate his age right now. He is 32. So he's been out for about 12 years. His life is not the same as it could have been if he was able to stay in the military, but he's able to do a lot better. You know, lots of people want to make assumptions that folks should automatically know. But if you've been reinforced in doing something for a year, it's hard to just come back and switch back, right?
In the same way, when people grow up in certain households, they can learn negative behaviors, maladaptive behaviors of parents.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we get to see a lot of different things when we are working with folks in the military, even their post-military experience around mental health. And I'm just happy to be positioned to be able to help, right? To be able to give the language, to give the information, to expand their knowledge base and their career and their lives and the lives of those who will come after them. The more information they have, the better it is for them to be able to live the life that they want. And that's the same with all of us when we're dealing with mental health issues. The more information we have, the better, generally, the better we can set our lives to be. We just need the information and we need the support. We need the access. And like we're mentioning in this conversation, we need somebody to advocate for us in times that we can't advocate for ourselves.
Brilliant. I think that's a great place to round up then. What a great summary you just So if people want to find out more about your work, because I know you do telehealth practicing.
We call it telemental health.
I think it's called something a little bit different here, which is why I stumbled. So potentially you're counseling people all over the world from your practice.
I am. And I've had the opportunity to travel all over the world and learn about mental health in other places as well and present at mental health conferences all over Europe. I've been to Europe quite a few times and talked about and explored the mental health services that are happening there, especially because the foundation of our mental health theories that we use in the United States came from some of the theorists there in Europe. So yeah, absolutely. If people want to get in touch with me, Instagram is everywhere, right? So we have our Instagram is our company page. So Onyx Therapy Group, O-N-Y-X, like the crystal, the stone, Onyx. O-N-Y-X Therapy Group. And then my personal Instagram page, which I love for people to follow as well, is Mahogany, like the wood, Mahogany Sunshine. Because as you can tell by my voice, I'm full of sun. So Instagram is the best way to have conversations with me about certain things. But for more direct support and information like counseling services, it would be our website, which is onyxtherapygroup.com. And those are the best ways. So we're on Instagram, We're on the internets, the webs, and things like that. And we love talking and chatting and helping people. I love to let them know that no matter what life has thrown your way, you have somebody who will stand with you, who will listen with you, who will support you, and who will advocate for you.
I love that. And you're right. It's so important. And I think that's very much reflected in looking at who makes up your team. You know, the other counselors that are there come from backgrounds where they'll understand from firsthand experience. And, you know, just like with any relationship, a counseling relationship, oftentimes people need that. They need someone that's experienced similar elements of their life. And yeah. So I think that's great. All right. So I will put some links in the episode description so people can come find you. Really encourage the listeners to do that. And thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.